There's a prayer by Chaitanya. The 16th century saint avatar who brought the chanting of the Krishna mantra into public purview. He says, my dear Lord, you have hundreds and millions of names, and you have very graciously invested all of your energies and potencies into every one of your names. There are no hard or fast rules for chanting your names. Anyone can chant your name and experience the bliss of that union with you through your divine names. But Chaitanya prays, unfortunate as I am, I have no attraction for them. So there was simultaneously in Chaitanya's prayers this exaltation and joy of realizing this coming together with Krishna through the sound of Krishna's name. And we're going to be talking about transcendental sound today, so it's quite appropriate. And at the same time, this sense of, we might say, a kind of spiritual despair. That I know this is true. I know that you are here with me when I say your name, when I sing your name, when I chant your name, when I pray your name. I know you're here. I know you're with me. But I don't feel that attraction that I should feel. I'm so far. You're so near and yet so far. So, shall we say, when done right, or when done with a full heart, the experience of chanting these 16 names, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, will break your heart. It's not quite the electric bass and experience that, which is also fun. There's no harm there. I mean, that's Chaitanya's prayer. There are no hard and fast rules. You can, you know, put it to a Ringo drum beat, or you can put it to a, you know, Michelle Indigo cello bass beat. You can, you know, do whatever you like with it. But ultimately, it's a yearning. It's a from the pit of the heart call. I want you, and I don't want anything else. I don't want anything else. I'm so fed up with everything else. I've tried it all. I don't want it anymore. It's the same old thing, just packaged differently. You know, that this world has to offer. How do I get you? How can I have you in my life? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. That's chanting. Chanting's from that place. Then magical things happen. There's a couple of handouts here. One, we've come to this very exciting place where we've entered into the fourth chapter. Now the soup starts to get really thick. The broth is getting savory here. The preliminaries, if you will, have been dispensed with now. And Krishna is beginning to reveal himself in a much deeper level. So would you kindly help me, John, by passing out these, for those of you who have been following along. Hey, brother, how are we doing?
I'm excited to get free Bhagavad Gita.
For those of you who have been here for Chapter 3, I thought you might appreciate having this summary of Chapter 3.
Can you email me so I can post it on Facebook for all our podcast listeners?
Sure, of course. Yes, hello to all of you out there in podcast land. Thank you for joining us. I think we're up to about 300.
Your lecture is now part of teacher training for two schools.
Really?
Yeah. No pressure anymore.
How embarrassing is that?
What?
I hope you get a percentage.
Yes, I get Actually, teachers get a percentage of the karma of their students. So, So be careful. Please treat gently.
It's like one of your friends in South Carolina and another one of your friends is a yogi teacher. And I want to say Switzerland.
Well, I know we have some friends in Slovakia who are following along.
Yeah.
And a couple of Russian sisters and brothers out there. So anyway, it's this lovely worldwide virtual community that we've begun. Thank you. So here you have the summary of chapter 3, and you're welcome to kind of look this over if you have any questions about it. But where we've come to now is a very extraordinary point. Now, I'm trying to remember, who was it last week, just before we get into chapter 4? Somebody asked me for this article on, it's called A Fierce Bodhisattva. Who was that? We were talking about anger and the channeling of that energy. How do you exalt, how do you reconcile a wisdom text that exalts ahimsa and yet ends in battle?
Xanthi.
Is it Anthony? Okay.
Xanthi.
Okay. Well, I have a few extras, so if any of you would like one, you're welcome to have this. This was a an interview by Krista Tippett on... do you know Krista Tippett on National Public Radio? Her show used to be called On Faith, I believe. And now she's changed the name to On Being or something like that. Here, would you? There's a couple left there. And if we need more, I'll bring in more next week. But this is an article about a woman police officer who became a Buddhist. And here's someone who has to discharge her weapon on occasion and who is yet contending with the discovery of this other part of our nature, which is to extend utmost and uncompromising compassion to people now, no matter how offensive they may be. So how do you reconcile these different parts? And it's actually no small thing. We've talked in the past about how international law attempts to do the same thing. International law attempts to reconcile the right to defend yourself, your country, your family, your nation against aggression. And yet at the same time, there are these international conventions that say you may not cause more harm than utterly necessary, absolutely necessary, in the pursuit of that defense of yourself, your family. So okay. Ultimately, it comes down to character. I mean, just to drop the other shoe here. Law is not mechanical, whether it be divine law or the law of the land, law is never mechanical. Law depends in every instance upon the character of men and women of righteous intent to implement the law. When the founding fathers, and they were after all fathers, wrote, "All men are created equal," it took enlightened minds in years after to go back and interpret that this includes all women are created equal and all minorities are created equal and that there should not be slavery. So what is law is a function, and the effectiveness of law is a function of character. Okay. Chapter 4, Bhagavad Gita. Any questions, by the way? Yes. A couple more housekeeping things. Ah, you're here. So you get your... what are our additional housekeeping issues?
Tiger Preserve, Potluck, and the...
Okay, what is the book's housekeeping?
The books are by donation. If you need a book.
Oh, if anyone... Yes, we have copies of Bhagavad Gita, Gita Wisdom, and I think some people wanted George Harrison books, which I did not bring.
You brought them. They're right there.
They are? Okay, fine. Thank you. And what was the next thing? Postcard of the week. Courtesy of Michael. We have these lovely little collectibles. Collect them all. And what we have here is thought and image from the Bhagavad Gita. This week it's chapter 9, Bhagavad Gita. Raja Vidya Raja Guyam Pavitram Itam Uttamam pratyaksha vagamam dharmyam susukam kartam avyayam. This is Raja Vidya, this Bhagavad Gita, knowledge of ourselves as divine beings, lovers of God, lovers of Krishna. This knowledge, now Raja Vidya can be interpreted in different ways. That's the beauty of Sanskrit, it has so many different meanings. Raja Vidya can mean that it is the king of knowledge, Raja Vidya, the king of, like Maharaja. And it can also be interpreted as the knowledge of kings, meaning that rulers are meant to be enlightened beings. They are meant to understand the progressive value of life and therefore guide the citizenry appropriately toward their spiritual fulfillment. So you can interpret that. Okay, so there you go. Yes. Potluck dinner. Yes, we decided the advertisement now says, if you have nothing else to do on Valentine's Day, come join us for our potluck dinner. Is that is our log line?
Can and share data?
Yes, please.
I just want to say, yes, a potluck is coming up in 2 weeks from today, and I can already smell the food. I'm for the year. Of course, I am sitting next to banana bread. But Kim is going to be offering her culinary expertise and offering the main course, but we welcome you all to please bring something, whether it be a dessert or a little specialty thing that you'd like to bring in to share. And if you would contact him so that we have an idea of who is bringing what, so we don't have 10 people bringing dessert and only one person bringing salad or whatever.
Sure. You can bring a quart of, juice or something or whatever you'd like, if you wish.
Flowers or fruits. Fruit. Salad.
Patram pushpam phalam toyam yome bhakte payachate. Krishna says, if one offers me a fruit, a flower, a leaf, some water with devotion, I accept it. Yes.
And also, in keeping with the Chukumukti tradition, making sure that everything is vegan and that it's not being, utilizing paper, unnecessary paper and plastics.
Cool.
And so, how do you want to handle that? Do you want us to contact your email?
Sure, you can email me or call me or just come and say hi after class.
And
that's
you
great.
Or share,
you can also share with both of us, right? Yeah.
So those of you who would like, kindly just coordinate with our chef.
You can communicate that to us through the Facebook page also.
Yes.
Okay.
And your email addresses will be posted tomorrow.
And we will post the email addresses.
We've had two of these potluck dinners, and the numbers have increased each time. I think last time we were up to around 50-something. You are welcome to bring a friend.
Are we dancing?
We are definitely dancing. Our dance mistress, Carol Tessitore, will be back to lead us in another Bhangra extravaganza. So wear your dancing socks. Okay. Fourth chapter, Bhagavad Gita. Kindly repeat the invocation after me, if you will, and then we'll recite the verse together. Chapter 4, text number 2. Evam parampara praptam. Kindly repeat with me. Evam parampara praptam. Imam rajarsayo vidu. Imam rajarsayo. Imam Rajarsayo Vidu. Imam Rajarsayo Vidu. Sakalena Hamahata. Sakalena Hamahata. Yoganashta Parantapa. again, the long line over an A extends it to a long ah sound. So parampara. Parampara. And the diacritic dot under an S, like the accent over the S, transforms a S into a SH. So Rajarshayo. Rajarshayo. And the dot, the diacritic under an H at the end of a line, gives it a kind of a stutter, viduhu, almost like a double H, viduhu.
It's almost. The dot under the S.
It's almost not really heard or enunciated, but viduhu. It's like an after wisp, viduhu. So, evam parampara praptam imam. Rajayasheo vidu sa kalin neha mahata yogo nashtak parantapa. Let's look at the synonyms together. Evam, thus, parampara, very important word in the Sanskrit lexicon, disciplic succession. Praptam, received. Imam, this, Prabhupada chooses to use the reference here, this science, and I can't remember who it was last week who asked this lovely question. I think it was you asked the question. Why is Bhagavad Gita considered a science and not an art? What a lovely, lovely question. Yeah, thank you for that lovely question. This science, Raja Rishaya, the saintly kings, Raja Rishaya, Vidu, understood, Sa, that knowledge, Kalena, in course of time, Iha, in this world, Mahata, great, Yoga, the science of one's relationship with the Supreme. Notice that definition of yoga. Science of one's relationship with the Supreme. Nashta, scattered, dispersed, lost. Parantapa, O Arjuna, subduer of the enemies. And we know that Arjuna has these many different titles throughout the Gita. So in this instance, subduer of the enemy. Translation, this supreme science was thus received through the chain of disciplic succession. And the saintly kings understood it in that way. But in course of time, the succession was broken. And therefore the science, as it is, appears to be lost. There's a very exciting new chapter. Again, the momentum now is building. We're going to discover some extraordinary themes of the Bhagavad Gita in this fourth chapter. We're about 1/6 of the way through. We've completed 3 chapters of 18. Again, the context, and we must always bear in mind the context of what's going on here. This is a battle. It's imminent. The soldiers are straining at the leash. They're holding their horses back. Everything is ready for this extraordinarily violent conflagration, which we know from Mahabharata will be the cause of the death of hundreds of thousands of warriors. So time is very short. And Krishna is having to abbreviate vast wisdom if he's going to rally Arjuna's spirits and get him ready to fight this battle in a very short period of time. So Krishna has to pick his words very carefully in order to effect this transformation. So how you say something is as important as what you're saying. That reminds me of the story of the elder brother who comes home after having been away for a long time and knocks on the door. The younger brother opens the door. Hey, how you been? It's great to see you again. It's great to be home. Hey, what's going on? I've been away so long. Hey, what's new? And the younger brother says, well, the cat died. No. The older brother says, that's not the way you break news. You think about the impact of your words. Choose your words carefully. You got to kind of ease into something like that. You say like, well... Oh, I have some bad. The cat was up on the roof and she got her paw caught, in one of the tiles. So we had to call the fire department and they came and they got her down, but there was a little infection. So, I had to take her to the hospital and they had to put her to sleep, but it was, you gotta, do it right. Okay, the younger brother says, I get it. The younger brother says, okay, so what else is new? How's mom? Well, mom was up on the roof and... So you pick your words carefully. That's the point. And what we started to discuss last week is that there are two. There's two kinds of knowledge. There's the avaroha pantha, path of descending knowledge, knowledge that comes down from a higher source, and the aroha pantha, knowledge which is from our own limited logic, intellect, research, experimentation, and so on. Such places exist, realms of higher wisdom that we cannot perceive or access through our own limited facilities, which is what this fourth chapter is getting into. Evam parampara praptam, that there is knowledge that is awarded, that is given, that is gifted when we are prepared to receive it. You know, and it's altogether appropriate that we should not have certain depths or levels of knowledge until we're prepared to understand them. It's like giving a, you know, a weapon to a child. You know, knowledge is power. And it's why we see sometimes abuse of that, you know, and it's just from speaking a certain vibration. Powerful, his words are powerful. Hitler never lifted a gun. You know, the top henchmen of the Nazi Party never lifted a gun. It created a sound vibration that set all of these other things in motion. It's a powerful presentation of how that knowledge is presented. There are many things that we accept that we cannot perceive. Yeah. None of us were there when the French Revolution took place, but we accept because we read about it, and we accept the authority of historians and so on. So there's an acceptance of authority. Right? You go to a doctor, and you know, you accept this person as hopefully knowing his or her job. No one's ever seen an electron. We accept that electrons exist. How do we know they? Well, through the evidence. You know, project an electron through a medium like liquid oxygen, for example. You see the trail of bubbles. So there are many things that we accept that we have no direct experience of. So Krishna is indicating here that there are these places where knowledge comes down. And to understand that knowledge and to make best use of it requires some preparation, some training. It's the difference between gyan and vigyan. Have we talked about these two terms before? Gyan is knowledge, the knowledge that you can accumulate through study and research. Vigyan is realized knowledge, practical knowledge, knowledge that you are capable of putting into action for the benefit of others. That requires training. Therefore, evam parampara praptam, through a chain of teachers. The way one receives and develops spiritual knowledge is with the help of a qualified teacher, a guru. This verse is actually inspired by and refers to a quote in the Mundaka Upanishad. Tad vigyanartham sa gurum eva abhigachet srotrim brahmanishtam. The Upanishads describe that tad vigyan, to receive that wisdom, that realized knowledge, that spiritual knowledge, tad vigyanartham sa gurum, to a guru one must approach, samitpani. Samitpani means with firewood in hand. In the olden times, you would go to your guru's ashram, and you would collect firewood for the homa, for the agnihotra, for the fire ceremony, and that would be your service. So you come with an offering. You come to the teacher with an offering of some kind. You know, apple to the teacher. There's a reciprocation. And it's not necessarily financial. You know, in the West, you know, if you have a degree, you get a salary and you teach. That's not the way of traditional cultures. In traditional cultures, there's no particular tuition that you have to pay. There's this tragic situation that I'm facing with my students at Hofstra, that some of them are just not going to be able to come back next semester because they can't afford the tuition. That's utterly tragic. In a Vedic culture, you paid according to whatever you could pay. You would come, some students would come to the guru, would sit under a tree, first of all. You didn't need to $50 million, you know, smart board equipped thing that's in under a tree. And you'd come, and if all that your family could afford was a bag of rice, you know, you'd bring some rice or some cloth or whatever you could bring. So the Upanishadic description is sotriyam samit pani, with firewood in hand, pani, samit, ring, gift, sotriyam brahmanistam, to what kind of a teacher? What are the qualifications of a guru? Shrotriyam means shruti. Shruti refers to the original revealed Vedic texts. So someone who is trained in the original science of self in such a parampara succession, and teachers worth their salt, if you will refer, they will offer homage, they will offer appreciation to whatever the lineage is that they come from. This is where I've received my knowledge. So it's not about me. It's about my teachers and the lineage, and I am passing on to you what I have learned from them. That's the tradition. So Shruti, having heard properly the revealed wisdom, and then Brahmanishtam. Brahmanishtam means they walk their talk. They are the embodiment of those teachings. And therefore, you know, to sit here on the asana, you know, in front of a class, poses a lot of responsibility on me. I have to walk my talk. I can't just, you know, be here and do this, say this, and then go do something else. I have a responsibility to embody the teachings as best I'm able. So that's the kind of parampara that Krishna is talking about in this second verse of the second chapter. There's a friend of mine, wonderful elderly gentleman in India named Dr. Desai, who before he became a Krishna devotee, was an extremely successful industrialist in India. And he was not going to be convinced easily by anyone. You know, as a wealthy person in India, he'd been approached by many sadhus and teachers and you know, for donations or to support a program of some kind. And he'd kind of seen it all. So when he met Prabhupada, the teacher whose Gita we're using, and Prabhupada was not insisting, but saying that the Krishna mantra is the mantra that is recommended for this age. Well, Dr. Desai wasn't just going to accept that on face value. And he said, why is that? And he was somewhat skeptical. He said, there are so many mantras. You know, there are mantras in the Balava Sampradaya, the Shankarites have their mantra, the Shaktis have their mantra, you know, the Shaivites have their mantras. Why the Krishna mantra? And Prabhupada said, well, here you have in the Kalasantana Upanishad this reference. The Kalasantana Upanishad is attached to the Yajurveda, one of the oldest Vedic texts. And there it's described that the Krishna mantra has a particular efficacy. It's particularly joyful. It refers to God in this intimate form of Krishna, who is this lovable cowherd form of the divine, and therefore we are repeating what is described in the text. So Dr. Desai, not one just to be, you know, once again, you know, taken advantage of, he flew to Baroda and engaged one of the leading Sanskritists in India to find a copy of the Kalasantana Upanishad, which was a very rare text. This person whom he hired found a copy of the Kalasantana Upanishad. He paid this person to translate the text. And sure enough, there it was, this 16-word, 32-syllable Hare Krishna mantra described in the Kalasantana Upanishad as recommended. So he was convinced on the strength of evidence. So here's what's fascinating about that story. It wasn't so much the fact that there was verification in the text. It was this one-on-one relationship with his guru. It was Dr. Desai's contact with someone who won his heart that made the difference. And when we talk about the parampara succession, and this is really where I wanted to come to in describing for you the second verse, yes, it's important technically that someone be coming down into the cyclic line so that there's some agency, if you will, some authenticity to the teachings. as important is how those teachings are presented. Character cannot be separated from yoga practice. We've talked about this many times. Character can also not be separated from the experience that you have when you meet a teacher. That's what brings you together. It's something in the heart that only you will know. And that's what happened. And Dr. Desai is now initiated. His name is Sri Nathji. And he's done some extraordinary, wonderful services in India. So it's personal. It's not academic. In fact, the word Upanishad means the Upanishad, coming closer to the texts, the wisdom, by sitting at the feet of a teacher. So that personal connection is always critical. And how such compassionate souls, wise teachers who walk their talk, behave is embodied in a story that I'd like to tell you. This is, don't tell anybody. That includes you out there in podcast land. This is from Radhanath Swami's next book, because I get the great pleasure of helping him edit it. So this is a story from his next book, okay? In the 11th century, in the South Indian town of Sri Rangam, Ramanuja was honored as one of the prominent gurus of the day. Ramanujacharya is one of the great Vaishnav teachers in the history of the bhakti culture. And one day, Ramanuja's guru, Mahapurna, advised him that he needed to receive a particular sacred mantra. Now, he had reached a point where he was ready to receive this sacred and secret mantra. And he said to Ramanuja, "I can think of no one more qualified to explain this mantra to you than the saint Goshtipurna, who lived in a distant town." So Ramanuja traveled by foot to this distant town, about 50 miles away, and there this teacher, Goshtipurna, told him, "You should come on another day." He was testing him. "Come on another day." So dejected, Ramanuja turned around and went back 50 miles to his home. Eventually, he had made this journey 18 times to see Goshtipurna. But he was never given the mantra. And Ramanuja was weeping and weeping, considering his disqualification, his lack of qualification to receive this sacred mantra. But still he persisted, because it was the order of his guru to come and receive this mantra. So the news of his sincere tears finally reached the ears of Goshtipurna, who then realized Ramanuja's sincerity. And the next time that Ramanuja came, Goshtipurna emphasized that this mantra could be given only to one of completely pure heart. He said, "Now you, for this reason, you have convinced me of the purity of your heart. So I bestow this mantra to you. And as far as I can see, you are the only one in the world who is qualified to receive it. And whoever chants this mantra will be liberated from all suffering and will return to the spiritual world." So he stared gravely into Ramanuja's eyes and said, "It must never touch the ears of anyone tinged with any material desire. You must never disclose this to anyone." Now, according to Orthodox tradition, a mantra is only given to someone who is qualified to receive it. So upon receiving this mantra and the explanation of this mantra, Ramanuja was trembling in ecstasy, and he bowed to his mantra guru and departed. As he walked through the town on his way home, his heart swelled with uncontrollable compassion for the suffering of all of the people of the world. And he thought about how much people suffered in the world. And he remembered the words of his guru that whoever chants this secret, sacred mantra will be liberated from all suffering and return to the spiritual world. So he stopped in this village and he turned around and he cried out to everyone in the village, "Please come to the temple, please come here. I want to give everyone this precious jewel." And so the news spread and thousands of people gathered at the temple. And Ramanuja climbed to the roof of the temple and addressed the crowd of thousands of people below, saying, "All of you are more dear to me than my own life. I wish to give you a mantra that will free you of all suffering and awaken in you the joy of your souls. Please repeat this mantra." And with the loudest voice he could summon up, he called out the mantra, "Om Namo Narayanaya."
Om Namo
Narayanaya. Everyone loudly repeated, "Om Namo Narayanaya." And he did this three times. And the crowd was, you know, responding in ecstasy. So Gostiparna got word that this secret mantra was vibrating throughout the town. He was shocked. He was furious. And while everyone in the town is weeping with gratitude, Ramanuja went back to honor Gostiparna. And seeing him, Gostiparna shook with rage. And he said, "Get out of my sight. Get out of my sight, you shameless fool. Today I have committed the greatest offense, the greatest sin, by entrusting this sacred mantra to a disgraceful person who cannot maintain a vow. I can't tolerate seeing you. You get out of here. For the offense you have committed, surely you will suffer in hell for countless lifetimes." And Ramanuja replied to him in soft, humble tones, saying, "My beloved guru, you told me that anyone who chants this mantra will be liberated. Now, if an insignificant person like me has to suffer in hell, that's a small price to pay for all of these thousands of people attaining happiness of God's shelter." And hearing this expression of compassion, Gostiparna's heart flooded with waves of affection, and he embraced Ramanuja and said, "You are an intimate associate of the Lord, and you are the great soul, whereas I am a common man by comparison to you. And from this day, you are my guru, and will you kindly forgive me?" So Ramanuja fell at his mantra guru's feet and prayed, "You are my eternal guru. Today you delivered all of these people with the mantra you gave me. And today you have blessed me with your merciful embrace. Please accept me always as your son, as your disciple, and as your servant." So this is Vaishnava culture. This is spiritual culture. You know, there are rules governing the transmission of things. At the end of the day, it's about relationships. It's about the love that we cultivate among ourselves and the compassion we feel for others. I mentioned that yesterday I had the great honor and joy of spending a few hours with Swami Chidananda Saraswati. The real goods, the real thing. And one of the things that we talked about was why is it that even among spiritual circles, it ends up being so problematic. It ends up with, you know, petty jealousies and people just can't get along. Why does that happen? And he said, it's when a contact deteriorates into a contract. When the value of a relationship is diminished down to a business affair, what can you do for me? And if you think about it, that holds true pretty much across the board, doesn't it? When it's what can you do for me, that problems begin. So in this second verse of the fourth chapter, what Krishna is pointing to is, yes, the importance of evam parampara praptam. Yes, the importance of receiving your spiritual teachings in an authorized disciplic succession. But as important is how that knowledge is received and the relationship that goes with it. What do you do with that? It's there. It's there. But unless it's being given by someone who has a soft, compassionate heart, you know, you can present something. The same thing can be presented in different ways. Totally opposite effects. Even the way you say it. "I love you." As opposed to, "I love you." I mean, it's the same words, you know. The teacher said the student is a fool. The teacher, comma, said the student, comma, is a fool. I mean, just a little comma totally reverses the sense of things. So how it's presented is critical. Be very careful with your words. Words are very, very powerful in how you present them. Okay. What do you think? Have you had the experience of maybe even something meaningful, but presented to you in such a way that you just couldn't accept it? I get that all the time at home. And I have to remind myself, no, just listen to the essence. Listen. Yeah.
I had a question about when you were speaking about knowledge versus realized knowledge, like young versus
vigyan.
Could that be translated as wisdom, the latter, realized knowledge?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that? Sure. You could, but it's wisdom put into practice. V is an active prefix. So it renders the word it is qualifying active. So vigyan means active knowledge put into practice. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting also that the Bhagavad Gita itself is written in certain stanzas in this kind of very poetic tone. And so sometimes when you hear somebody recite something to you that could be very beautiful, if they don't have the musicality or the intonation that goes with the Sanskrit, it can be a totally different experience as if somebody is on the harmonic and playing it very nicely. Mm-hmm. So that's what I
say. I hadn't thought of that. That's quite true.
And being able to be, people always say, you can be receptive to the vibrations of Sanskrit, but what if the vibrations themselves are changed a little bit before they get to you? It made me think of that.
Oh, yeah, that's very good. And it raises some very challenging questions. If this knowledge is absolute, if we say, we talked last week, I think, about Derrida and deconstructionism and the notion of something having a reality outside our perception of it versus value that only exists because we have imposed that value on something. So can there be something that has an absolute value separate and apart from our perception of it? And therefore, for example, the mantra, like the Krishna mantra, if that's an absolute sound, that's a transcendental sound, that's powerful, does it have the same effect on everyone, no matter how it's transmitted or how it's received? And the answer is absolutely not. There's an extreme difference. I think you're quite right about that. That you can browbeat someone with the intent of winning their submission, or you can make an offering from the heart, and that will have a very different effect. That's a very good point. Which is also why there's so much training behind the recitation of the verses. Just to master grammar, tradition says you have to spend 12 years just learning Sanskrit grammar. Thank you.
What was your original question again?
Whether anything can have an absolute value separate and apart from our relationship to it. In other words, there's a Bengali saying, milk touched by the lips of a serpent produces a poisonous effect. Now here at Jiva Mukti, we may have a little problem with that little analogy, but soy milk touched by the lips of a serpent, the idea being that soy milk is by nature sweet and wholesome and health-giving. But if it's touched by a serpent, its quality changes. So the mantra may be pure, but if it's being put out there by an entertainer, if it's being put out there by someone who's putting on a show for money, or if it's being in, you know, I remember when Hair was on Broadway, you know, they're chanting Hare Krishna every night. Well, did that have the same spiritual value as a devotee's chanting as an offering of love to Krishna?
You mean like false gurus? People that claim they're gurus but they're really demons?
Does Krishna talk about the idea of emptiness in the Bhagavad Gita, of shunyata, of things don't have an absolute reality from their own side, but only exist according to our interaction with it? What's that?
I don't think there's a verse that specifically talks about shunyata in the Bhagavad Gita. At least I can't think of one off the top of my head.
But that's basically what we're talking about, no? Or something different?
No, I believe you're right. This is what we're talking about. And this will speak to what you're asking. Yeah. There are verses in the Gita where Krishna says, for example, that when you've reached a point of true self-awareness, you'll become indifferent to all of these scriptural injunctions. That's coming up rather soon, as a matter of fact, because Arjuna used this as argument, as a way of avoiding fighting. He says, you know, the scriptures say we should not harm anyone. You know, the scriptures say, you know, respect the authorities of the society. And what Krishna says to him is, you know, when you stop all of this word jugglery and you come to a point of really knowing yourself, those scriptural injunctions are going to fall aside. They're not going to have the weight that you're trying to give them now. So that's some of that. There are other places as well where Krishna describes that the Vedas, the scholarly wisdom of the texts, are for people who wish to advance themselves materially. Scriptural regulation, I think, and there's a parallel here, so bear with me. I'm struggling to make this comparison, but I believe it might be valid. The need for a blueprint for your spiritual life is important as long as you're not on solid ground, and there's need for bolstering our lives materially. This is something Krishna acknowledges himself. He says, a lot of people come to me because they're in trouble. They need money. They're insecure. They're in need of something. I know that they come to me for that. He said, there's another kind of person who comes to me, and that's out of love. And I kind of have a special interest in that person.
My favorite
line. Huh?
My favorite verse.
Yeah, it's a wonderful verse, isn't it? The scriptural injunctions, religion per se, religion on the level of prescriptions for how to live in the world, are meant for material ends. And what Krishna is urging Arjuna to do is go beyond that. Go beyond the formality of the knowledge, the formality of the mantra, the formality of this, the mechanics of it, and get to the heart of it. If you come to the heart of it, that's when the nectar, that's where you find the nectar. That's where the bhava, the ecstasy is. And that's not a matter of scholarship. That's not a matter of...
like the sword.
Yeah. Yeah. What is your motive? What's in your heart? So I'm not quite sure it's answering your question, but my understanding of this verse of the fourth chapter is that he's saying, look, follow teachings, get teachings in the proper, from the proper place, but then make sure that it's got a heart to it. Don't just make it mechanistic, mechanical. Yeah.
What I was thinking about when you were asking, do things have an intrinsic value or only what we ascribe to them, was feelings. And there are certain things that seem to feel good, like helping people or telling the truth versus lying. You know, there's a feeling that you have that is better than not doing those things. And so I was thinking, is that, I don't, in that instance, I don't think it's because we all collectively agree that it's better to tell the truth or it's better to help someone. I feel like in that instance, that is something that just sort of exists universally, that it feels good.
But people don't
do
that. Do
you understand what I mean?
But people don't do that. It isn't universally accepted. Most people look out for number one. And probably so.
Right. Well, I'm not saying people do it, but I'm saying that I don't.
Up until like 30 years ago, the Western culture was kill or be killed, every man for themselves. The means outweigh the method. I mean, these were like Western philosophies.
What happened 30 years ago?
His guru came to America, and the yoga movement started. And that was like basically a big part of like European American philosophy, like all the enlightenment philosophies of like the periods of enlightenment was like modern economics, and you know it was about the good of the individual outweighs the good of the masses. So if you do business for yourself and try to crush your enemy, then you will create a problem.
Right. Some of you may know Peter Ressler, who comes to our gathering sometimes, who is a Wall Street insider and occasionally will remind us that the slogan on Wall Street was "You eat what you kill."
Yeah.
But I think, Xanthi, what you're pointing to is that there is some background truth that endures despite these kinds of social and cultural anomalies, which may for some time impose on us this notion that, you know, we work for number one first, that there's some other part of us, if you will, the spiritual part, the transcendent part, which responds to kindness, which responds to love, compassion, that sense of the greater mystery. No matter how heavily you're indoctrinated, you know, even the most cutthroat, you know, materialist may keep a vase of flowers on his desk. Now, there's some part of us that reaches out to that. Am I understanding you right?
Yes. Yeah.
We all have a soul.
Listen to this verse. This supreme sais was received through the chain of disciplic succession. The saintly kings understood it in that way, but in course of time, the succession was broken, and therefore the science, as it is, appears to be lost. This is precisely, I think, what Krishna is referring to here, that we start off on this very idealistic, if you will, progressive spiritual path, and then because the world is what the world is, at some point, there are these magnets that draw us away from that path, and that impulse to the better part of ourselves gets compromised. And so therefore, he says in the next verse, so I have to come again. I reestablish the teachings. And I suspect that may be what we're seeing right now with the yoga culture in America, at least in theory, is that reestablishing of a different way of being in the world. That we've been materialistic for so long, so it's created its own, you know, antithesis. We might hope so.
Yeah, there's business models that are coming up now about how economics is really about better economics is about helping
enlightened self-interest, sort of.
Yeah, like, you know, businesses run better when you help your community rather than crushing your community. Mm-hmm. And so, people are starting to dabble.
What made me think of that is Kim lent me this book on raising children with spiritual principles. And I need all the help I can get. So, and there was a part in it that said, you know, it's Deepak Chopra, you know, no discipline. I'm not into discipline. Well, I mean, I haven't finished it, so I don't want to misrepresent it. But he said, you know, you have to give children the experience of their feelings. So don't say to them, don't lie. But point out to them, you know, how does it feel when you lie versus how does it feel when you tell the truth? And shortly after I read that, you know, my daughter's six, so thankfully I can still tell when she's lying. And she said something that wasn't the truth, and I kind of pushed her on it. And then, you know, she did tell me the truth. And I said, Bix, you know, doesn't it just kind of feel better? And I was like, I don't know how this is going to go. And and she was like, so, pardon me?
I thought you were done, sorry.
No, I am done. I was really surprised that mm-hmm. that was so clear to her, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that those are relative feelings. Without knowing what the bad feels like, there's a continuum of feelings there. That's why I think the discussion of absolute truth is difficult, because it's hard to, in a vacuum, it's hard to know what something feels like without having a frame of reference.
Mm. We're not really taught to feel as children, though. I know my parents never really asked me how I felt about things. It was always pushed aside because feelings are uncomfortable or painful or a strange sensation in your mm-hmm. body. So my parents never really taught me how to feel. And I had to learn it as an adult. But having three boys, I always wanted to be able to teach them how to feel. And I mean, it's not easy, but we all need to learn how to feel, I think. I think it's something that we push aside too often. We don't allow ourselves to have that, whether it's uncomfortable to be loved or to love somebody.
Yeah. All right, so this is an interesting thread here. And the question is,
Is there
some part of us? Now, we know what the Gita's answer would be. The Gita says, yes, there is absolutely an integral and indestructible part of ourselves, the Atma, which is by nature compassionate, loving, emotive, experiential. It's real, it's substantial. You know it's there, and it responds to goodness, it responds to beauty, it responds to grace. It responds to all the things that our best instincts tell us are the bright side of life. So the Gita would say, yes, that's there. So I'm wondering, where does the question arise whether it exists or not? Yeah.
I think, like you said, the Gita obviously says all this, of course. From my little understanding, you know, that's the main point. But this passage, I think, it points out that, like, that's true, but it's a science. So a science, you have to, like, replicate things. It's so much discipline, and it's constant experimentation and using the tools you have to practice. And so without that discipline and study of the subject matter, none of that can be realized. So maybe it's there, but it will be so obscure unless you approach it as a discipline science.
Hmm. That was nicely said. I think you're right on track there with what Krishna is describing for Arjuna. it may be natural, inherent to all life, this higher self, but it's so buried in there that it takes that constant discipline to revive it, to resuscitate it. Am I correct in understanding what you were just saying?
Yeah, revive it, and then once it's revived, you can maintain it.
Maintaining it also, sure.
It's quickly... Mm-hmm.
Reverts back.
Reverts back.
Yeah, this indication here that the disciplic line gets broken, that wisdom gets lost, that it's buried. You know, and this is classic mythology now, where, you know, there's the treasure in the cave, you know, it's the gold that's guarded by the dragon, you know, it's there in every culture, and it has to be, you have to work to get it out, you have to fight to get it out again. Yes.
I was just going to add to Newman's comment that one of the things I sort of struggle with is, when does critical inquiry help you within, you know, this understanding of yoga as a science, and when does critical inquiry manifest as a sign of sort of lacking faith, or, you know, sort of diverting you? So this idea that Arjuna at times sort of but this says something, and that's sort of a diversion tactic, and when you can actually do, like the person you mentioned earlier, sort of, well, let's go have a look at the text, let's really research this, let's sort of, you know, use some rigorous study and knowledge, and that kind of takes you closer. So I was just going to sort of compliment Nina as well on her comment, sort of tapping into this idea that there are scientific qualities to the practices, and that sort of rigor is kind of that solves.
Yeah. Well, that's a lovely insight, that sometimes we can use the rigor of study and discipline as a way of avoiding the real work, which is to soften the heart. Yeah, very, very good. Why would we do that? Why would we do that? Why would we use our yoga practice as a way of avoiding the very purpose of yoga? Why would we engage in the study and the discipline of bhakti or devotion in such a way that it keeps us distant from others instead of its purpose, which is to bring us closer? Why would we do that? Where does that kind of contradictory behavior come from? First of all, does anyone acknowledge this? Does this ring a bell for anybody? Okay.
You don't know. Yeah. I guess you don't know what's going to happen. Right? If you know what it's like to study and be in control, and you know what distance feels like, you don't know what merging feels like. I would say for myself, that's just kind of like a bit.
So just fear of the unknown?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Can I jump in? I know there's hands. I feel compelled to jump in. So I'm taking advantage of that. But to your point, I thought it was such a great point about the experimenting. I think that, because that is a scientific approach, but it's so against what we're taught. I think when we experiment with our feelings, with sharing what is really happening, we run the risk of losing somebody, of them removing themselves from us. So it becomes such a hard thing to do, but yet it's so appropriate. And I wonder if that's why we hold it back so much. Go there. We experiment with this approach. There's a lot at stake in doing so.
Oh my gosh!
As a child or as an adult.
John, I don't think the stakes get any higher. I mean, we're dealing with the retrieval or the loss of our souls. And, you know, when you get to this level of what is happening here between Krishna and Arjuna, I don't think the stakes can get any higher. So, it's a point well made. Yeah. Right, and run away, and it's going to follow you.
Right.
You can't run away from it.
To leave it,
right.
And not face it, to stay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the real lesson there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So So what? But translate this practically. If someone's just walking in for the last time, and hasn't been hearing what we've been discussing, how would you summarize this point? Because I think there's like four or five different strands to this. We started off with the question of, is there an absolute separate apart from our perception of it? Right? I think that's where we started. And from there, we went to how, even if there is, that there is something in us, this was Xanthi's contribution, there is something in us that is drawn to what we might call the higher self. Whatever our social, political, economic, ethnic, religious conditioning may be, there's something that seems to be a universal magnet for people, that we are drawn toward the light, toward something better. And is that not an indication of some universal good that exists separate and apart from our value judgment of it? All right? And then we kind of segued into a discussion of how do you get there, and why it is that we would maybe out of fear of that thing that exists separate from us, use our yoga practice or our study in such a way that we can say, oh, I've dealt with that now. I don't have to go any closer. Am I correct? Have I got the beats of this so far? And I think you... I'm going to ask you to say your names here so we all kind of get acquainted. Alexander was describing that there's a fear factor. Is that... Can I... That if we lay ourselves bare, we're vulnerable. Right? In the hope, perhaps, and we don't want it to be a naive hope, that there is a Krishna, that there is an Atma, that these two are joined in love. And that kind of, you know, poetic hope that this kind of a beautiful world actually does exist, are we perhaps acting in a naive way and leaving ourselves vulnerable to what? Humiliation, embarrassment, loss of credibility, loss of family and friends. Maybe there are all kinds of reasons why we wouldn't want to really take it that far. Right?
There's also a fear that when you're seeking harmony, it's not real.
Oh, wow. That's good.
That's
yeah.
Back.
The idea that I've been hoodwinked. That this whole, you know, Om Shanti thing has really just been some big illusion because the rest of the world is so horrible and we had to have some place to go to. So this has been a kind of a nice incense-laden construct.
Right.
Right?
It was all made up.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's part of the
wow.
Pulls people back.
All right.
Maybe part of the issue is that we want our choices to always lead to a positive outcome. And maybe it's also accepting the fact that it may not, and I don't know what the outcome is going to be, but something needs to tell me this is the right way.
Yeah. I can't, wow. I don't know how we got here, but I'm really glad we did. I have friends, and I'm proud to call them friends, who are seriously committed to their spiritual practices, who are this close from bolting. This close because of what we're talking about. One, it is so threatening to my sense of self-worth. You know, that this is so antithetical to the path that I had carved out for myself until now. The way one person said it to me was, developing love for God was not on my bucket list. It's just, that was not on my to-dos, right? And some can't deal with the discipline of it. Some men I know who have been in the brahmachari ashram, you know, have taken vows of celibacy, and just have decided they can't do it anymore. They don't want to do that anymore. And yet there's a kind of an embarrassment about that. As though admitting that you actually have emotions and needs and a physical self is somehow a put down. that somehow diminishes you spiritually, right? What a, my gosh, what a horrible stigma to have to live with. And yet it's out there.
Yeah, if you want to go through life and say, I don't want anybody to get enlightened if I'm single, alone, celibate, and a recluse. Mm-hmm. That's the only path. I mean, that's like, you know.
All right, so what are we saying? That there are a lot of reasons to not keep going with your yoga.
Or maybe to just find a different approach. Because ultimately it's about relaxing. If you are doing this really oppressive, mm-hmm. repressive, mm-hmm. it might just be keeping them. I mean, maybe it's a karma thing. It's mm-hmm. not the time. But maybe it's just a matter of not being on the right track.
Yeah. Maybe don't lose your sense of humor.
Yeah. I mean, there are, you hear these stories of enlightenment with, you know, crazy method like Brahmacharya. So it can happen any way.
Yeah.
Which actually I had a question about that. The Krishna mantra being that's prescribed for the Kali Yuga, how is there any reference in the Upanishads or anywhere else about why that particular mantra? Why that mantra?
Well, that's all, we could have a whole session on that. Did I ever pass out that sheet of references from the Vedas?
No.
There's. Would you remind me, and I'll be happy to do that. There's quite a number of places where the Maha Mantra, the Krishna Mantra, is described as appropriate. I think not the least of which is that it's joyful. It calls to the divinity in male and female form, which not all mantras do. You know, Hare is the vocative of Hara, which is the name of Radha. So we're evoking the feminine divinity even before Krishna as male divinity. So there's that, it's got that going for it. Then you have Krishna, who is a god of love and play and pastimes and lila. He's not a god of wrath and chastisement. He's a god of come, let's play together. So there's that joyful quality as well. We could have a whole talk about that one. That's a lovely question. Thank you for the question. Yeah.
John said something interesting kind of in passing where he said we each make decisions and we hope that they lead us to a good place. That everybody is trying to get to some place of joy and that we make assumptions on how we get there. Do you know Robert Anton Wilson? Quantum mechanics and quantum physics scientist, and he said we're all living in our own reality zones and we don't realize how narrow our view really is, but that's what gives life its flavor, is all of these different reality tunnels, and that in fact when we are able to acknowledge that I'm just coming from my own reality tunnel, I may or may not be right, but I feel good about my decisions, kind of like what Xanthi was saying. It just feels good sometimes for me to do things like tell the truth as opposed to lie. Mm-hmm. And somebody else might not have that experience. But we don't live in a vacuum, like Frank pointed out, so we're able to at least realize that we do make an assumption like Krishna exists because I haven't met him that I know of. But even if he doesn't exist, even if there isn't an absolute reality, would I still continue to live the way that I do? And I would say yes. And that's what that's the difference between questioning yourself.
Krishna may be a myth, but find me a better one and I'll follow that.
Yeah,
right. it's not a terrible answer. It's such a beautiful
concept. I don't want to live in suffering.
Yeah.
And that includes second-guessing myself all the time.
There is also, I think, what Xanthi's pointing to, and I agree, that was, thank you, Xanthi. Have we talked about this story of Mortimer Adler? Adler was probably one of the great 20th century philosophers. He is one of those people Bill Moyers had interviews with on PBS. Adler tells the story of the myth of Gyges. Gyges was a poor man in ancient Greece who had only one valuable possession, and it was a gold ring. If Gyges put this ring on his finger and turned it around, it would render him invisible. Gyges had the misfortune of falling in love with the queen and finally reached a point where he couldn't take it anymore. So he puts his gold ring on his finger, turns it around, becomes invisible, goes into the palace, kills the king, and runs off with the queen. So Adler poses the following question. You're walking down Fifth Avenue, and you walk by Fortunoff. I'd say Tiffany's, but for many reasons I've got to say Fortunoff. And in the window, you see a discreet little black velvet box with a ring in it, and then underneath there's a sign. The sign says, Ring of Gyges, reasonably priced, inquire within. So he poses the following questions. He says, would you go in and ask what the price is? If you'd afford it, would you buy it? And if you bought it, what would you do with it? Now, obviously, the reason he's posing this, I'll get to you, I saw your hand, I'll just pose you, get to you in a second. The reason he poses this story is, who among us can say that our intuitions are so strong that we can wield that kind of power nobly for completely unselfish reasons? And ultimately what Adler is saying is that even if you had that kind of power, to misuse it, while you may escape the laws of the land, it wears away at your soul. When we behave in a way that we know is hurtful, whether or not we feel justified on an intellectual level, on a political level, a philosophical level, whatever, there's some part of us that begins to deteriorate. You know, it's the picture of Dorian Gray. No matter how beautiful you may think you are, there's a part of you that's deteriorating when you act against Dharma, when you act against the well-being of all. And that's, you can't prove that scientifically. It's not something you can do in a test tube, but there seems to be something so compelling about it that it seems to hold true wherever we look for it. Yeah, just one or two more thoughts. Rodney, you had something you wanted to say?
Yeah, what's it? Who do you know? Is that going to answer your question? I says, you got to know yourself. There's something called something that's missing. So you have to find yourself, stay at one with itself. This way you got to find who you are. It's not finding anything outward. It's just going to change. The inward is going to be the same. Just like stay inside yourself. If you like to read the book because you feel the book. If you feel well, don't be attached to it. The thing is, if you feel you love, then that's the greatest gift there is. It's like I would say, in all this practice in that book, is teaching love. It's like victory over suffering and pain. You can do a lot of things. You have a lot of power to relieve yourself. Just give all, stay as one, and you're not totally separated. All these things don't let it interfere with your mind as long as you keep yourself the same. You have a lot of things. Just be yourself. You were given the gift. The body and the mind is beautiful, and the spirit. It's here to learn all these things that Joshua and Jules and he's talking about. The thing is, learn who you are. That's the greatest thing. That's why you're here. You were made that way to find who you are. If you feel you have to do it, then you set a goal. You set what you need. You can't set anything else. You spoke about the kids. If you give your love, you are the truth. The more you give, the more you get. Stay the way you were born. Don't change. Be one, and you got everything.
Rodney always manages to just like, boom, bring it right down, right to home. Brings it right back home. Thank you once again. Yeah. That may be, I know for myself, is like, you know, confession time here, because you guys bring it out. Thank you so much. Probably the hardest thing that I've had to contend with in the past 2012? What's 82? It's 18, 30 years since I left ashram life, is accepting what Rodney's talking about, that ultimately, you really do have to like yourself enough to trust your own intuitions, because nobody can tell you. Nobody can dictate the truth so convincingly that it should dissuade you from following your gut and what you truly feel in yourself. And that's a tough place to be, because how do you know you're not following your imagination or a wounded psyche that compels you to think this is truth because I need it to be truth. I need this to be true because otherwise I'm going to have to face my own unworthiness, my own imperfections, my own ugliness. So I need this to be true that I'm powerful, or I need this to be true that I'm whatever. How do we know when our gut is the super soul in our heart talking with us and not our imagination? That's why the mantra, keep chanting. Keep chanting. Consciousness becomes purified, and at a certain point, you will understand the difference. You will know the difference intuitively. I think that's what Rodney's pointing to. Stick to the practice. That's why this is a regular discipline. Stick to the practice, and eventually, the way Prabhupada said it once is that nobody needs to tell you when you're full. You know, if you've eaten enough, you know you're full. Wow, I don't know where we got to and how we got there, but I'm really always thankful for these get-togethers. Can I tell you one last little story? Is that all right? And it's about finding the heart of truth in things. Michelangelo is reputed to have been walking down a road with a friend, and they were just kind of, it was a warm Italian day, and there was a rock by the side of the road, and Michelangelo's friend, in a playful mood, went over and kicked the rock off the road. And Michelangelo said, "Why did you do that?" And his friend said, "Why did I do what?" He said, "Why did you kick that?" And it's just a stone. And Michelangelo said, "No, that's not a stone, that's an angel." Yeah, you artist types, you're all alike. So they went on it. About a week later, the friend came back to Michelangelo's studio, and there on a pedestal was that rock that Michelangelo had retrieved and out of which he had carved this utterly exquisite angel. And he said, "I told you it was an angel." What changes, I think, is vision. It's not some kind of external reality that the world becomes something different from what it is. It's what we're perceiving and how we're perceiving it and why. And I believe that what the Gita is telling us to do is trust this much, if nothing else. You are a divine spark of me, Krishna says. This much you can trust. This you must know intuitively. You are a divine being. You are a part of me. You are not different from me. And if you trust that much, that there's something in you that is so real and good and whole, that it is inevitable, that nothing can assail that, when the time comes, you'll make the right decisions. Whether it's in the scriptures or it's not in the scriptures, or whether it conforms to social etiquette or it doesn't conform to social, it will conform to your inner reality. So keep chanting, because that's a beautiful place to come to. And I think when we come to that place, then we can start really making a difference in ourselves, you know, in the world around us. Thank you.
Oh, Panchikalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyaivacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo I offer my homage and thanks to all of you, the Vaishnava devotees of Krishna, God, because you are like desire trees that can fulfill the wishes of everyone, and you are full of compassion for the conditioned souls of this world. Thank you for your company. Your friendship. Hare Krishna. Have a piece of banana cake.
And we accept donations.
Yes, we do.